Hey, lovely listeners. I wanted to give you a trigger warning and a heads up that listener discretion is advised on our next series, Victim F.
You two haven't seen each other yet, so what is that moment like? How does that happen when you two finally see each other?
Like every moment in captivity, I kept picturing him. I kept just visualizing what that feeling must be like to finally feel safe in his arms again. And so when he knocked on that door and I open it, I mean, we just embraced and like we're just crying and holding each other.
I knew our lives had changed forever and that we're gonna go through a lot more struggles, but like we're together and we can.
At least you had each other.
Yeah, at least we had each other now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, host of the podcast Crime Analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me today is
Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and executive producer of Fox's new America's Most Wanted.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the tenacious, intrepid journalists who pursue those cases.
And we have a very special guest joining us who's actually a repeat guest who we're very excited to speak with.
I'm Nikki Wisensee-Egan, and I'm the author of Chasing Cosby, the book, and host and executive producer of Chasing Cosby, the podcast, and co-author of the new book, Victim F. From crime victims to suspects to survivors.
And we are very pleased to have you back on, Nikki. Thank you so much for joining us. And the last time we spoke to you actually was about your book and podcast, as you just introduced, Chasing Cosby, that we did a deep dive on and we spoke to a number of survivors as well. Tell us about your new book, Nikki. It's really a very interesting case. Tell us about how you got involved with Victim F.
Sure. My former agent actually connected me with Aaron and Denise. I had heard about the Gone Girl case back in 2015, and I remembered it, and I remembered the bare outlines of it, but I certainly didn't know all that's in the book. And so I was really drawn to it because the one thing I want to do as working on my own is I want to do projects I'm passionate about. And the more I learned about this, the more I was just outraged. It wasn't just, you know, the kidnapping and home invasion and the rape, which was horrible enough. And what was done to Aaron, questioned for 18 hours. And he keeps cooperating because he wants them to find his girlfriend. It's what happened after, you know, the press conference the police held, calling the whole thing a hoax. Denise is called the real life Gone Girl in headlines across the world. So I was really drawn to it, and they really wanted to do a book. So I co-authored with them, and that's how we, you know, started working on it. And we got a contract with a fantastic publisher, and it was just, there was more to it than even I knew. Like I say to them, you know, I think every step of the book, you keep going, surely now it's going to turn around for them, right? Right. And they caught him. Now things are going to go their way. And it's not, it just, another thing happens and then another. And they're just very, you know, strong people, and they just stuck with it because they just want him to stay behind bars for the one of the guys. I mean, the other two are still out there somewhere.
But so, Nikki, how on earth did you get them to trust you? Because they'd been thrown under the bus by the media itself. I mean, they must have been very wary about you approaching them and then figuring out, you know, how to tell the story, that it's such a unique way of telling the story. I think Jim and Laura and I have both said we devoured the book. You know, we inhaled it. It was just such a page turner.
I tried very lightly. I knew that they wanted to write. So, and I thought this book would be better first person, like each of them. And they had started writing sort of a little draft of it. They had like the first chapter with alternating points of view. But the more we got into it and we got some feedback from our editor, it just seemed better to like switch back and forth. When I saw all that Aaron had gone through for 18 hours, you know, that's what I think a lot of people did not realize is all that he was going through in that room in the police station. Yeah. And then I just thought, you know, I interviewed all of their family members because I thought, I think people really need to know what's going on outside of their perspectives too, because there was so much going on with both of their families, with the police and in the community. You know, this was a huge, scary thing for the people on Mare Island where Aaron lived. Yeah,
I really like the fact that you had the multiple perspectives, first person telling their story and weaving it together. It did make it a page turner. Because you want to know, well, all right, what happens next? Oh my God, I can't believe it. But it was filled with, no, I don't, what? They did what? You know, it's fine for them to suspect the boyfriend at first. Mm-hmm. It's not fine that they didn't do any investigation. It's not fine that they just literally made a decision that that's it. We're not doing anything else. We've locked in. And then it's also not fine that the FBI just jumps right on board. Despite the fact that his brother is an FBI agent, you would think that that would have, you know, encouraged somebody in the FBI to say, oh, this is pretty serious. This guy, I mean, I'm sure his brother vouched for him and said, no, he's not a murderer. And two, he's not somebody who would lie to law enforcement for whatever sick, fucked up reason. So to have, well, we kind of then eventually understand a little bit more of why the FBI agents who were actually involved might have been a little biased because they weren't disconnected from this case.
Right. And we still don't know what all that's about. I mean, there were just so many parts. Like I think I wrote in the acknowledgments, there are very few cases that can outrage me after all my years covering crime. But this was one of them, because from the moment that, you know, Aaron called the police, you know, the police walk into his house. And what do? The kidnappers put this camera up there that's watching me, and they walk right over and yank the plug out of the wall. That's evidence, right? Isn't that evidence? And you're just destroying that. There was evidence everywhere. There was the red duct tape that they had put around for the perimeters. There was the phone charger they left. There were the zip ties. There was evidence everywhere. But it's like they decided from the minute he made the call that he did it. And I again, like you, I get it. You know, usually the boyfriend or the husband is the person who did this. But, you know, the kidnappers were in contact with him already. And they still were contacting him, as he later found out, even while he's being questioned by the police. And they're telling him they haven't heard from the kidnappers about the ransom. They had opened the emails that the kidnappers sent. So clearly, I don't know if they read them, but they'd opened them because you can tell that. And there were three missed calls from the kidnappers on Aaron's phone, but the police had his phone on airplane mode. Meanwhile, Denise is being raped twice. And yeah, the police could have been the heroes in this case. The Vallejo police could have been the heroes in this case. They really could have.
They'd done their job. Yeah, right. Done their job and investigated it, which, yeah. I mean, it is a case where for Aaron, it didn't look good, admittedly. And I've worked many of these cases, but whoever put the phone on airplane mode, is there any sense of who that might have been? Because I have no understanding of why someone would put the phone that is the main line of communication to this potential kidnapper or kidnappers, why someone would make a decision to put it on airplane mode when it's a live operation, a live investigation. That just completely blows my mind.
It wasn't a live investigation. They literally refused to do a live investigation. They did the exact opposite. They told him, you killed your girlfriend, period. We're looking for a body somewhere. We're not going to investigate this abduction. And part of it, though, I believe, especially after having read in detail several times the affidavit for the warrant, I believe the plan that they made partially was to make Aaron sound crazy when he reported to the police. That I think it's so absurd. And it, you know, they literally said, there's going to be misdirection and obfuscation. We're going to lie. We've told you things that were not true. All that stuff. When you put all that together, whoever came up with the plan was very sophisticated in terms of that. And, you know, obviously, because one of them happened to go to Harvard, it was probably he probably had a lot to do with it. In my experience, and I believe in Laura's experience, when you do have multiple people coming together to commit a conspiracy, to commit a violent crime, that one of them is usually the leader and the others are followers. two leaders don't often like to play together. You know, they have a lot of head bumping going on. But when one of them is in a position of power and authority over others, it works out so much better. And I think that's probably what happened. It was one main actor with flunkies, people that he used for certain aspects of it. But I think he considered himself like the ultimate criminal, and he just needed some people to help him execute certain things, but that it was all on him. You know, that's how I see it.
And, you know, it could be. Honestly, we don't know, because we don't know who right. these other two people are. And I've thought about this a lot myself, and I've talked about it with Aaron and Denise, because the one thing that I thought against it is that every time this Mueller does something on his own, he screws it up. So he had had those two or three previous cases, and he was already a person of interest. And then the home invasion after the Denise and Aaron thing, he goes by himself. There's no recordings. There's no wind machine, you know, noise machine to drown out everything. He brings his own darn cell phone instead of the burner phones that he had been using. And he screws up and he leaves his cell phone behind. I'm not saying that's the case, but he and his job, if you read the emails and believe some of what they said, was to do the biographical research on get the intel on the yeah. on this.
But that's totally inconsistent with his history. That's a completely inconsistent yeah, with his known history. But what I'll say is what you just said argues for exactly supporting what I just said, because yes, when he does it on his own, he screws it up, because he's not a sophisticated criminal. He is forensically sophisticated in that he can think and plan, but he doesn't have a lot of experience successfully completing these crimes. So he's not criminally sophisticated enough to actually pull it off on his own, which is why he needs help to control people, to do logistics, to get things from A to B. So that's why when he's alone, he can't manage to pull this off. There's too many working parts for him to manage. And had he had 20 years of experience breaking into homes, successfully burglarizing places, successfully abducting people, successfully doing what he does, then it would be a different story. But he's not that sophisticated on that side of the spectrum.
That's why I don't think that necessarily he is the mastermind here, simply because of that.
Well, Aaron, your names were only cleared after the assailant struck again several months later. Can you explain how that happened?
Yeah, we did our best to try to get the police to actually investigate this crime. Denise, even after they labeled her as a hoaxer, she went to the police for 2 days of questioning, and they did investigate because we knew these guys were dangerous. And unfortunately, a few months later, one of our assailants attacked another family. And in that case, they were able to fight him off. And the detective from Dublin, Misty, did the exact opposite of what Vallejo did. And she went above and beyond and tracked him down. And when they went to South Lake Tahoe home, where Matthew Mueller was staying, they found my laptop. They found a long blonde hair attached to swim goggles that were similar to what we wore, which the family in Dublin didn't have. No one had long blonde hair. And eventually she tracked it, traced him to our crime. And if it wasn't for her and her partner, I don't know where we would be. Our reputations wouldn't be restored. I don't know if we would be working. And
she saved our lives.
And I got a call from his half-sister like last week or the week before. And it was interesting because she tells me that, well, you know, he got disbarred in 2013.
Right.
But I said, well, was he working, what was he doing since then? And she said, no, we don't know. He's living in Palo Alto. And so he had no visible means of supporting himself, which is why I tend to believe parts of the emails that they were stealing cars and all those things were verified. All these burglaries happened. In fact, the car that the second car Denise was put in was the car stolen that they write about in the email, the white Mustang, the guy like hightailing it around, speeding too much. That white Mustang from that email was the one Denise was in. And that's the one that Misty found up at the house. So then they graduated to another level. And then, you know, then this was their first kidnapping for ransom. So that, you know, I, I don't know. I mean, we'll never know probably, but it's fascinating because I've never seen anything like that too, where the kidnappers then, you know, the police hold this press conference saying Aaron and Denise made the whole thing up. And then the kidnappers write these emails saying, no, 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 we did it and we'll prove it to you. And here's all the proof.
I think that's unprecedented.
The pictures. Yeah.
I don't
certainly
think
not
that's
something
ever.
I've heard of before. So complete anomaly.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is, like in the Center City Rapist, there are cases in which we try to encourage communication between the offender or offenders and law enforcement. And in fact, that's what solved the Center City Rape case in Philadelphia and Colorado, because we got him to communicate. And then we were able to trace back the writing materials that he used and so forth, and lockdown that it came from Colorado and so forth, and then look for a series of crimes there, and the rest is history. But so there has been situations like that, but I have never heard. And, you know, I worked for at the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime for 12 years, and I'm still in touch with people since then for the last 11 years. And I've never heard of any offender actually communicating with law enforcement to support the victims that they just abducted and raped. I think it's an anomaly. It's a unique case in that manner.
It's better for them to be perceived as a hoax. It's better to see Denise and Aaron go down for the crime than to have it.
Of course.
I just wanted to ask real quickly, Nikki, was there ever any evidence that Mueller had taken a deposit from this mysterious person who presumably was their sponsor and who had pointed them in the direction of the abductee? I mean, is there any evidence that that person actually exists or existed?
The person that supposedly hired them. Yeah, Aaron's
and gave them the name of who he wanted abducted or robbed or whatever it was.
Well, the sad thing is we don't know, but there's never been a real investigation of this. Like, even Misty will tell you, I don't know if you've spoken to her yet, but she really wanted to do more of, even more than she already did after the FBI took all of the materials from them, do more of an investigation. And the FBI would not let her have access to any of it. And also then SESMA just stopped communicating with her. Because as far as we know, they never found these emails that were sent on Mueller's devices. And they did find the recordings. They did find a lot of the evidence, the zip ties. In fact, it was in the goggles, the swim goggles with the long blonde hair, which is what made Misty say, I know there's another victim out there, because none of the victims in her case had blonde hair. So none of that's been found as far as we know. And even the way part of the email is written, it looks like parts are cut and pasted.
Yeah. And so he's looking at it. He said, you know, I mean, he said he would get to it this week. So we'll probably find out what he concludes next week.
I sent him, right? I have actual Mueller writing samples too.
Can you forward them to me, or does he have them still, do you think?
I don't know if he's, I mean, I'm happy to forward them again, but I'd send him a lot of those too, because of course, how do you know? It's interesting to know if he wrote it, but even if he did.
Yeah, if you could send them directly to Fitz.
One person wrote the whole thing.
Right.
But they also say in one of the follow-up emails that it sounds like they did talk to law enforcement, that they had a call, but they got off. So there's just so much we don't know. There's just so much we don't know. And it's sad because these definitely are guys that were going to do it again. I mean, that was their plan. And it's interesting because Aaron said that one of the FBI agents told him at the preliminary hearing that they had looked into whether this group had been involved with the kidnapping of Cal Ripken's mother, which was a few years ago, but ultimately ruled that they didn't think it was. So I don't know if there were like code words used. Like, I don't know if that whole thing about there, we've done this before. And then the person that we was going to tell police, so we left a cake on her doorstep as a warning. I don't know if you remember those parts from the emails. So, I mean, Mueller was very, you know, there's the whole wide dark web out there where he could connect with people. He's told some people it was people he met through his job as an immigration attorney that were his accomplices. His family told me he's never said word one to them since he's been arrested about this, which is interesting. And, you know, maybe he's keeping silent to protect his. He has a wife. I think he has, I don't know if he has a child, he has a family. So, you know, he's staying silent, but that was kind of interesting too, that he's never talked to them about this.
Just to take a back step a little, because this is a complex and complicated case. And we've gone into the affidavit and sort of things that have happened later on down the line. The thing that really interested me about the case, first of all, was, and Aaron said it straight away when we interviewed him, was the stalking element. The fact that there had been stalking, the fact that Aaron had been watched, his house had been watched, the fact there had been a break-in, and all of that preparatory behavior is very interesting, because I've just spent the last 3 weeks in the heads of predatory stalkers. And I have to tell you, it's not a good place to be for anybody. But it does give me further insight into, you know, when someone stalks, when they're doing preparatory behavior, what's the motive? What are they trying to achieve from it? And there are really only a number of things. In this case in particular, we know that when they were woken up, Aaron Denise, at gunpoint, they were told this is a robbery. We know it wasn't a robbery. Okay, so the motive, I keep going back to that, because if you've got stalking, if you've got preparatory behavior, you know that someone's a target somewhere down the line. There has to be. But the fact that the house is broken into a week before, the thing that we don't know is, was Jennifer Jones stalked, for example? And we asked Aaron and Denise the same question. Do we actually have any information or evidence about Jennifer Jones and whether there was any preparatory behavior regarding her at the address she was living in or her workplace? Do you know the answer to that, Nikki?
No, we don't. And I think I've told you, I've thought some of her behavior is very odd, as you read in the book, that encounter when Aaron tries to talk to her at work about it. The joking about and the joking on Instagram with her now husband about being kidnapped and raped. And, you know, Mueller speculates, you know, Mueller plays this cat and mouse game, as I put in the epilogue, where he drills out these little pieces of information and hints that possibly the cop that Jennifer was cheating on Aaron with was the one who hired them to try to scare her back into his arms. She's now married to him and has a baby with him. So there, and he, you know, he's a cop who had been fired for like stalking women online. You want to talk about stalkers? That's what he'd gotten in trouble for, was looking up women he wanted to date in the police databases and finding out information on them. And there was like some chop shop that was busted. And supposedly that's what Mueller and these guys were doing, that he was a part of that. And that was, I think, nearby in Mare Island. So the stalking too was a part of figuring out the schedule, you know, and they had the drone too. They had the drone that they used to spy in, you know, in Aaron's windows, because his house back to a marsh, you know. It's a fascinating question. And no, we don't know. I mean, and she, you know, just, she isn't talking and her behavior has just been strange. So I don't know. I mean, she certainly doesn't seem scared, which you think she would be if she were a target, you know. I would be,
right?
But it's odd that she's married to him now too. Like, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, her reaction and that whole exchange Aaron had with her when he's trying to get some answers out of her, and, you know, her behavior there. So there's so much about this case that just doesn't add up.
The shifting conversation that the voice has with them, of this is a robbery to this is now a kidnap for ransom, to now I'm going to have to take you for 48 hours, to now I have to have sex with you. And by the way, just the now I have to have sex with you, of course, creates a huge problem for a victim. He's not talking about rape. And we talked a bit about that with Denise and Aaron, just how problematic that is, and particularly the police response as well, which I'd like to hear your thoughts and observations on, particularly Matt Mustard and his response in terms of how he views women. So we know that Denise is let go 48 hours later. There's no monetary exchange at all. And to Jim's point, you know, and I remember being in the FBI, we talked about Dennis Rader, for example, who FBI started communication with to reel him in. So that was a proactive strategy. But I can't think of any cases where a perpetrator or perpetrators would then risk being detected and advocate so vehemently and so passionately for the victims against police action. And that part, again, is just one of the biggest question marks for me. Why would he put himself at risk? Well, he calls it reverse Stockholm, doesn't he? Or whoever writes the letter, there's an inference to reverse Stockholm. If there was obsession to begin with, which I wonder whether Denise's interaction with him actually kind of consolidated that and increased his obsession with her. Because when you talk to her, actually, Nikki, she is a very special woman in the way that not just she looks, but the way she interacts and her compassion and her humility and her gravitas and her being. There's an awful lot more to Denise. And Jim and I both said exactly the same, actually, having spoken to her, that we could understand where that sort of infatuation and that obsession that we, throughout his behavior, the pseudo caring, the looking after, the way that he interacted with her, and he made it her problem as well. She had to problem solve this with him, and she had to interact with him in the sexual, well, in the rape, effectively. And that is very striking just throughout the whole time that he kept Denise and in the house as well. And then he's still advocating for her afterwards, risking everything by doing so.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts around that?
Yeah, and I think we talked a little bit. I think that he's a power reassurance rapist. You know, I remember that again, the Center City rapist, when he was doing those rapes, after he raped these women, he would tell them how not to be victims again and tell them, oh, you should lock that door I got into or watch that window. And, you know, even down to him scrubbing the floor before Denise came in there, from my understanding, is he hadn't been living there before he took her there. It was his family's vacation home. Now, subsequent, after the kidnapping and after he released her, he was staying there, and that's when Misty found him there. I mean, I think they might have said robbery in just a general sense, not knowing like the legal term that a robbery is not what this is. This, because all the recordings were, this is a kidnapping for ransom. You know, we're going to take this. These were pre-recorded, and they had his ex-fiance's name on it. So, you know, I think that was the plan to do that. And then things got messed up because it was the wrong person. It was not Jennifer Jones, it was Denise, but they decided to go through with it anyway because it would be good training. And they had told Aaron not to go to the police, and they put this monitoring stuff. Supposedly they were putting monitoring things on their phones, and that camera was supposed to be like a live stream. As we found out later, though, they couldn't get the password to Aaron's router, so that's why the camera wasn't working. The software they brought to monitor the cell phones didn't work with their version of the iPhone, and a backup router they brought broke. So they were so well prepared in so many ways. That's, again, doesn't make me think he was in charge of it. So, yeah, so I think that once they decided to take her and do it as a test run, I mean, they then did start the whole process of getting the money. They contacted Aaron with the emails, and you will take this much out of your bank account. And they gave him a charger to go. So, but I think Mueller probably used all of that to his advantage. He is a sexual predator. There's no doubt about that. And then when he had Denise there, I mean, he said he didn't have any intel on her, so they were going to use this to blackmail him, so that, you know, because he had a fiance. I don't know. I mean, I also love to know. I think he probably committed rapes or peeping toms or whatever it was back in Boston when he was at Harvard that we just don't know about. I bet there are victims there, because the only ones that were really traced back were the ones Misty found in Palo Alto and so forth.
So you just said you don't think he was the one who did it because they were so well prepared, and that when he does it on his own, everything gets fucked up, right? But those three things that you mentioned that were supposedly well prepared all got fucked up. They were all insufficiently researched, insufficiently carried out, I mean, executed. So that, again, it's just, to me, these are all like, you know, weights that you put on one side or another. And I don't know for sure, because we haven't identified who these other two guys are, at least two other guys, right? But that's the kind of thing. If somebody who really was adept at that kind of stuff was doing it, then it wouldn't have been fucked up. They would have cloned his IP address and reset the password, so they wouldn't have to ask him for the password. They could have done so many things technically, you know, and supposedly, you know, with the drones, using drones to surveil them and so forth, you know, all that kind of stuff is pretty technical. But if he's a half-assed person, you know, a kid can operate a drone with a camera and be proficient with it in a couple hours. Anyway, that side of it is that. But when you're talking about it seemed like what you're suggesting is that since he had her, he decided to go ahead and act out his sexual predatory proclivities. I believe, and I'm sure Laura believes, that that is not a since he had her, but his main motivating factor in doing all of this, because this is part of a progression of events that started years earlier, many years earlier, and eventually progressed to breaking into homes and attempted sexual assaults to I'm taking her to a place where I have more control and sexually assaulting her, to trying it again later, but not coming to fruition. So it looks like that whole pattern of behavior is very consistent with a long-term plan and development of a predatory sex offender, repeat sex offender.
The layperson that I am, I mean, even when I was reading the book, I was just wondering, so if the real Jennifer had been there, so you don't think they would have taken her off the premises, that she would have just stayed there bound? And then what was the plan if it wasn't Denise that they realized? I mean, what was the plan with the real quote unquote Jennifer being there, just to keep them bound and then have them get their money out of what was the...
The recording said they were going to take Jennifer Jones for 48 hours.
So they were always going to kidnap her. They were always going to take her away. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And it was a kidnapping for ransom. And it was like a test run and they were doing these lower amounts. And no, I just meant like, supposedly, if you believe the emails, Mueller was not the one who was in charge of the technical stuff. That was somebody else. And as you read, I mean, it's
no,
you can talk for hours. It's so fascinating on so many levels. But I think that he released her because Aaron had gone to the police and he knew that. And so that's why he went ahead and released her, even without getting money.
But in almost every kidnapping, that's what happens. But the police are involved throughout the payment, and that's where they track the payment. That's where we usually catch them. It's the exchange for the money for the person that usually is their weak point. And so the fact that he went to the police doesn't negate the fact that if it's a kidnapping for ransom, then it's not negated just because he went to the police. In fact, they went on to brag to the police and to the world through the media what their plans were, what their future plans were, how they developed. I mean, all that is just, it's insanity. It's extraneous information that only caused them to be caught. And so again, not criminally sophisticated, bright, but not criminally sophisticated. That's what that behavior screams out to me. But on top of that, when you talk about where he was in terms of what he did, how much interaction he had with the victims, why he was called the voice, right? All of that. Why do you think that is consistent with him being the one who has to take her, being the one who is the only one who's interacting with them verbally? Why do you think somebody who just did the background, right, who completely fucked up the background, is given that responsibility? I mean, he did completely fuck it up. But when we talked to Aaron and Denise, and I think the original disconnect with them was when we said it, they assumed that we meant that somebody found Denise and decided to stalk her and then followed her to Aaron's, and stalking her and then targeting her and then deciding to do the abduction and the whole rape situation. But what we feel is more likely is that they were surveilling Aaron's place. They had been in Aaron's place before. They saw documents with the name on it, JJ, right? And so they just assumed that the woman who came and stayed over was this JJ, right? Knowing nothing about JJ at all, just assuming the person who they see, that must be her name, JJ. And so the fixation was by sight. The fact that they saw her there, they most likely spent time in the house when she was in the house. I don't know if she was there the week before. I don't think she was there the week before when
they did the test run.
They were in the house, but there's too much police activity. Well, that's a completely bogus excuse, because there was no female in the house that day. So why wouldn't that be the reason they wouldn't do it? If they came there to abduct a female and charge a ransom to practice this kidnapping, then of course they couldn't do it when there was no female there. What are you going to do? Abduct Aaron and then who's going to go to the bank? I mean, it's just ridiculous. So that was a very see-through attempt to make it seem as though they're not as much of a bunch of clowns as they want to be perceived as. But in fact, they are a bunch of clowns, and which is why I believe that Mueller was the leader, because any professional kidnapper would not have made the huge mistakes and would never have allowed whoever to write those emails, giving away everything about their history and making them so much more vulnerable to law enforcement. I just really think was so full of himself that he didn't think he could ever get caught. But real criminals,
right?
They develop MOs to avoid getting caught.
Stupid. Right, but then you do something so stupid the next time you do it, and you—that's how you get caught, because you left your cell phone there. You didn't, you know, you didn't have accomplices to help you
control
make sure
them.
These people,
right? Exactly. And, you know. Yeah, that's it. And why? Why wouldn't he have had accomplices there? Because the guys who he used the first time said, "No fucking way! You fucked it up last time. Whoa, the cops are going to be all over us. I'm not doing it." But he is so driven by his desires. This is need-driven behavior. Sexual need-driven behavior, not money, not $8,500. I'm going to get $8,500 for this thing that's going to put me away for 40 years. Come on, that's ridiculous. It's the sex drive that did it. That's what we believe was his main motivating factor.
And that could be true. I don't know. I do believe, they needed money, though. He had no visible means of supporting himself. And, yeah. You know, as they say, even in the emails, the car stealing and the burglaries weren't getting them much money. So this was
they were certainly getting more than $8,500. I can guarantee you that.
Nikki, yeah. Your book says that they think that Mueller was living on Mare Island with a girlfriend. That's in your book. So is there a possibility that he saw Denise, you know, running, jogging, driving around, seeing her going in and out of Aaron's house and became fixated on her? And then, you know, when he broke into the house, just assumed, you know, her identity was whatever he saw in the mail or something like that.
No, I mean, I truly seem to believe someone hired them. I do believe that. Wow. I mean, there's just enough. I do believe that. And I'm not even that. And that whole little thing you put out there about who possibly could have hired them, you know, the cop who was trying to send Jennifer Jones back into his arms. I mean, that kind of rings a little bit true to me. It seems like something, talk about a predator. That cop is a predator, that retired, that, you know, fired.
Does he have an alibi? Does he have an alibi for that night? Maybe he's one of the
but people.
No, he hired them. No, you would have hired, he wasn't there. I'm not saying he was there. Right. But he could have been the one behind it. And no, it was hiring. It was just, you know, yanking someone's chain.
All right.
The sad thing is we'll never know, because there's never been a good investigation. And we were talking about Mustard, you know, going back to that, that's the thing. Like these kidnappers were communicating, you know, if this was all some ruse, they were still communicating. They sent the emails and texts to Aaron. And even after Aaron went to the police, there were these emails about the pickup, and then they called three times. So, you know, it was just on Tuesday. Then they released that proof of life from Denise, and then the police sort of had to shift and like, oh well, she's alive. I guess he couldn't have killed her. So they made the whole thing up. You know, it was just like it, just because it was bizarre. You know, because the kidnappers right. were wearing wetsuits and all of that. So, you know, look at the famous Sam Shepard case, right? The one-armed man. It turned out to be true. He was a suspect, but it was bizarre. The Jeffrey McDonald case.
He was convicted, actually.
Yeah, wait, but didn't he get exonerated eventually? Didn't they find the killer eventually, the real one?
No, that I think they are suggesting that there was a one-armed killer, but really not a good profession for a guy with one arm to be in. But yeah. Can you tell, what is the evidence that somebody hired them?
Oh, no, I don't know what the evidence is, except for those emails and everything they've said. And the sad thing is that evidence could exist, but we'll never know because the FBI has
because computers. Laura and I do not believe they were hired. I know Aaron specifically said he doesn't believe they were hired. I'm not sure what Denise thinks, but the fact is that if they had been hired, I think that would, again, cut against them making public statements. Oh, we were hired by these people to go after this person. Now, right now, that person is completely free. Nobody knows about him, that he ever existed. But now we're going to tell the world that somebody hired us to go after her, JJ. Well, now they're going to look at any connections JJ has. And so that puts the people that, quote, hired them at risk. Those people would have gone and killed the guys they hired if they had done that. It's a very, very dangerous thing for them to do. The only reason why they could say publicly that they were hired is because it takes suspicion off themselves and puts it on some unknown entity. You can investigate all day and all night, and I know you won't ever find them.
Right. No, I mean, that's true. I mean, it's hard to separate truth from fiction with these guys. And again, it's a theory now. We don't know.
Right.
Because it's not like he's talking even and saying what he knows. He's saying nothing. Could it have been? Yeah. I mean, could have someone have not hired them, but just wanted them to do this? It's a possibility. It's also possible that that's not the case, that this was just their little group coming up with this thing. And he got a fixation on Jennifer Jones when he saw her. She's a beautiful woman. As far as the Mare Island thing, now, I don't know if you remember the part in the book too about the Mare Island, the Peeping Tom that was in the, yeah. On Mare Island the summer before. Yeah, so that was going on. And actually, a couple of the people had traced it back to where Mueller was living with his girlfriend and called the police. The police did nothing. So, I mean, but Denise didn't really start coming there till a little bit after. Jennifer Jones still lived in the house until September the previous year. So, I mean, and from a distance, I mean, they really look nothing like body shape or anything, but other than, and Denise has got this pretty golden blonde hair. And Jennifer's is more, it's a different, it's more of a bleachy blonde look. So, but still, I mean, anything's possible, but I just do believe, you know, that's a lot to come up with on the fly when they're writing that email the next morning. That's a lot to come up with. If you're just making all of that 9,000 word manifesto and this, so we did, you know, it's to come out of fiction and say, we did this and we did that and we were all this. That's a lot to make up on the fly. But, you know, and that the sad part is like the police and the FBI were just convinced that Aaron and Denise wrote those emails, or maybe their lawyers, and they had these, and, you know, and that's what I think why Mustard was ignoring the emails and the calls, because in his view, Aaron wrote those emails to himself.
Can we just say SESMA and whatever, not the FBI, because I'm certain that the entire FBI would never have done what those guys did. And the FBI should have fired SESMA for what he did. That's just outrageous. How he treated Denise when he interviewed her and avoiding Aaron and JJ, it's just very clear. He was too close. He should not have been.
The other thing to say, you know, that everything's being discussed, there are hypotheses. They're not theories. Nothing is proven as a theory until you have facts and evidence. So there's lots of hypotheses. And actually, Nikki, Jim and I work with possibilities and probabilities. And yes, there are many possibilities in this case, but it's very rare. And again, you get the 1% of cases where you have a shifting motive in a crime. Having worked Tiger Kidnaps, if it's kidnap for ransom, it's kidnap for ransom. It will not change. The overall aim is financial gain. That will not change. This has possibly three to four shifting motives if you believe what they say. Jim and I aren't as much interested in what they say. We're interested in what they do. Behavior. It's their behavior, their deeds, and their actions. Fitz will be very interested in what they say. The linguistic analysis, and Jim and I would look at the linguistics of it. But I have to say, to when they open up the offense, if you will, the crime, they wait, Denise and Aaron, this is a robbery. It was a very declarative statement. And that's normally used as a compliance check, actually, to see how people respond. So we can't take them at their word for what they say. And I do believe Denise and Aaron in that there were multiple people, but predatory stalking cannot be ignored and ruled out here, namely because we know that there was stalking behavior, there was preparatory behavior, namely that we know that it's only when the voice sees the driving license that he is thrown. That's when things start to unravel in a different way. So it's the driving license, it's not the way she looks that has thrown him. And that, again, is very important for us to understand. We can think about the fact, and Aaron told us actually, that he still had some of Jennifer's possessions. Not many, but just things that were in the house at the time. He didn't think Jennifer had been stalked beforehand. And of course, we hear JJ's name in the recording. But the money, it's not a huge amount. It's huge risk for very little reward. To try and orchestrate an offence like this, it's huge risk. And to take someone with you is, again, huge risk. But the way that he behaves with Denise, we have a problem. One of us is going to have sex with you. The language, the fact that he videos it, you know, that tells me it's fantasy driven, fantasy derived. And we will speak to Misty. We've yet to speak with her, but I can see that this is a very manipulative individual who makes her complicit in her own rape. And that causes problem for the police down the line. But she goes into survival mode, and quite right too. And we said to Denise, she did everything right. But the language, how everything played out, he has thought about that, I can tell you, a million times. He may not have acted it out in every way that he could, as he had her held captive, but he had thought through every detail, and he invaded her soul by making her part of that rape. And even the language, sex, she survives it, but she doesn't know she will survive it at the time. And because we know his behavior post-offense, he lets her go, he advocates for her, but he does break into another address. But we know he has completed that rape. It was a success. So I believe it's wrong to say he wasn't successful, because with the rape, he was. And that would have empowered him. And he goes into another address where two victims were non-compliant, which threw him. And then we have a phone that's left. But he does talk about the adult daughter that is a young daughter that's in the next bedroom asleep, who it's most likely is his next target. But he was successful in that rape. And that predatory stalking, that predatory rape behavior, the fantasy-driven aspect, and the fact that we know that Mueller has been charged, but for federal kidnap, he's been convicted, but not rape. That bothers me immensely, because it means he will, if he's not put on trial for it, and if he's not convicted, he will have a false forensic profile, because I believe he's a rapist first and foremost, predatory stalker rapist first and foremost, petty criminal, you know, smartish guy, lawyer, but not criminally sophisticated, as Jim said. The fantasy's been there for a long time. So it doesn't surprise me he's not talked to anyone. But I think that rape charge, him going on trial, is absolutely critical that that happens, because otherwise he won't be seen as a rapist. And just think about Cosby, who is so vehement, so rejecting what he has done, which most sex offenders do. They create a whole scaffold around themselves that they're not a sex offender. What I see with Mueller is that he's a sex offender, a predatory stalker first and foremost in his behavior. And I can't ignore that.
We've got so much more to talk to you about, Nikki. There's just, this case is just something that you just, there's just so many, it's like Swiss cheese. There's so many holes in it. There's so many questions in it. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing off.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website, where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow, on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.